Welcome to the Ion Basketball Podcast, the Pick and Troll Podcast. I'm your host, Zach Harper. Matt Moore, we're back after a little hiatus. And as Tara Reid says, sometimes I don't get what's better, hello or goodbye. Isn't it really the same? I have no idea what she's saying there. There's no... I mean, I guess in Hawaii, aloha is hello and goodbye, correct?
Yeah, maybe that's it.
Maybe she's in Hawaii right now.
She's so spiritual.
Sure, I would call it... I would maybe peg it as spiritual, but yeah, she's something.
Well, I nickname her that, Tara Spiritual Reid. So we were off yesterday. I completely forgot because I was up late writing a thing on Wings, and then just forgot in the morning, and then you had stuff to do in the afternoon, and then you had some car trouble.
Yeah,
don't go into it because it's...
We'll go into it, but something happened to my car that wasn't my fault.
So I thought maybe we could just talk about things that'll cheer you up.
Oh, sure. I will say this. Before things happened to my car that didn't, that weren't my fault, I was playing basketball last night. In the first game, I was hot. Like, I just came... I hadn't picked up a ball in probably 3 weeks. And I came out firing, hit a bunch of shots in a row, and then didn't hit a shot for quite a while. I actually shot really poorly for the majority of the night. But there was a point where I shook someone so badly that he fell down. And that was, like, I haven't done that in years, and so that was a really good feeling.
Did you give him the narcolepsy?
He kind of just it was just like one of those, I'm going to lay in a hammock right now.
It was the stretch out.
Yeah, the stretch out. It was... I did a pick and roll and got a big man switched out on me and hit him with a double crossover, and he fell. I actually didn't even think it was that good of a move, but it got him to fall. And so in and one fashion, I threw the ball into the stands and ran away.
Nice.
Not really. I passed the ball off for a missed layup, but hey, it was a good move.
My big highlight of yesterday was I asked Greg Popovich 2 questions and didn't get popped either time.
And you got him to talk about the government shutdown, saying that it's like kids in arguing over their toys. Was that what it was?
It's like kids fighting over their toys.
Yeah.
He was great. It was amazing. I asked the question, and there's this pause. And then it's at that moment, and like, I'm still talking. I'm asking the question, and he looks at me, and he's got that dead look on his face.
Yeah.
And so I start falling into the pop vortex, which is you want to keep talking to try and make the question sound better.
I'm not going to lie. I don't want to give you any crap here, but you did sound a little nervous.
Oh, I was terrified. The other reporters were laughing at me because they came walking down the hallway, and I literally jumped to the other side of the hall. And he's like, what, are you scared? And I was like, yes, I'm terrified. It's Popovich. I'm terrified of him. I dealt with him for a month last year, and I was terrified the entire time then, too. He's terrifying. I'm not scared of Boris Diaw in his nice sweater or Tiago Splitter in that leather jacket of his. I'm terrified of Greg Popovich.
Right.
So I asked the question. I started to ramble a little bit, and then he just kind of answers it dead. And then you can hear in his brain, he's like, ah, what the hell? And he goes ahead and he goes off, and I was like, yes, this is amazing. And then after I posted it, which, by the way, is hilarious because I'm making this huge deal out of it. I'm like rushing upstairs and like calling my editors and like, I've got this thing, but it's like political, so we need to make sure that the language is okay for you guys. Like, we have to go over this. I need some review. Nobody else has this yet. I'm the only guy with a camera. I've got video. And the editors are like, I don't know why you're making a big deal about this. Like, it's nice, but there's not... And meanwhile, I'm like, I'm thinking I'm in All the President's Men is basically right. What's going on in my head. Like, I'm breaking some deep story here when there were 5 other reporters around, because that was the other thing I'm racing against. I was like, please don't tweet this. Please don't tweet the thing I said, right. Which, by the way, I've done hundreds of times, is tweet things that guys have said to other reporters' questions. I was like, please don't tweet this. And they didn't care. So they did not. And got the story. And then I asked him later. I told him that everyone was wanting him to run for president, and he started laughing. I got Greg Popovich to laugh.
That's great.
I'm thinking about quitting.
It's not going to get much better. It's really this isn't even a knock on you. Like, it's just philosophically, it's not going to get much better than that.
Like, I got Greg Popovich to laugh, and then I never wrote again.
Yeah,
that's it. Some stuff has happened. I'm trying to think of all the stuff that's happened since we talked. It's been a while. It's been Thursday. All I want to tell you, let's start here. I'm starting to go back on Kobe again.
You're going back.
Yeah, because now it seems too obvious.
It's too obvious, the language saying that he's not going to play?
Yeah.
So he's now going to play.
Because like the other day when he told Kevin Ding of Bleacher Report, which is still weird to say, he said, you know, if tomorrow is a playoff game, I'd probably play. And, well, that's probably like I would do anything to play regardless. I still feel – he also was like, well, I did get out there and I was doing full water running. And he said, you know, I'm probably going to practice in the next couple of days. He said he was planning on practicing yesterday, on going out and doing full practice. Now, he didn't. He just did running.
Right.
But we're 2 weeks out. If he starts practicing tomorrow, you tell me Kobe Bryant can't be ready to go in 2 weeks?
Yeah, I guess it's – what is practicing though? And that's not like an Allen Iverson channeling at all. Is practicing like doing a couple of drills here and there, or is it 5-on-5 contact?
Well, let's say that he doesn't do 5-on-5 contact until the Saturday before the season starts. So he's got 4 days.
If he gets to 5-on-5 contact at any time before the season starts, I believe he'll play. Yeah.
Yeah. I keep thinking more and more that this is I think he's telling people he's not gonna, because Brian Shaw seems genuinely convinced that it's not gonna happen. Like, I asked Brian Shaw about it, and he was like, I don't see it happening. He's like, I'm not his doctor, I don't know, but I can't see it happening. And then you wrote today about Mike D'Antoni saying basically the same thing about how it'd be tough for him to make it back.
Yeah, he was asked after the – I don't know if it was today's game or if it's tomorrow's game.
Yeah, I can't keep track of that either. Like, the games overseas give me real problems.
Yeah, the Warriors played the Lakers, and after that game in China, a reporter asked him, you know, any chance Kobe is available for – or any chance he plays in the first game of the season, and he said essentially, no, I don't think so. You know, it's still an ongoing process, but it would be real tough. And so, I mean, his immediate reaction was like he just said no and kind of laughed at it. And then you could tell like there was a little click in his brain where he's like, oh, I got to be more political about this.
I could definitely see this happening where everyone's like, oh, you know, I just don't think it's going to be possible. And even like the week before, Kobe's like, you know, I'm working hard, but it's not one of those things I'm going to rush. I just, you know, when I'm back, I'm back. And he said that before. He's like, when I'm ready, I'm ready. And you know, it doesn't really matter. We're not going to need me. And then open. And then on the day, it'll be, you know, he's feeling pretty good.
He'll drop.
He's feeling pretty good.
He'll drop 30. They'll lose by 18. And
yeah, exactly.
And that will, and such will be the Lakers season.
And Nick Young will wonder what happened to his shots. Man, he was chucking. The last preseason game I caught the Lakers wasn't this one, but the one before that, he was the last Nuggets game. It was impressive how much he was shooting.
Why wouldn't he shoot?
Just going. I guess maybe that's the good thing about the Lakers is right now with the way that they're kind of structured, like no one feels any pressure. Like you're allowed to pretty much do whatever because it's we got to figure out something that's gonna be good.
Today and today's game or tomorrow's game or whatever game it was in China. 23 minutes, he had 18 points on 7 of 10 shooting. He also had 3 assists.
Oh, my favorite, my next favorite, we've entered in the next phase of preseason, which is we've gone from muscle watch to now, oh, he's expanding his game. He's a different player.
Oh, yeah.
I've got Boston fans crawling up my timeline saying that Jordan Crawford is now a playmaker.
I love Jordan Crawford. I've enjoyed what I've seen from him during the preseason, but that doesn't mean like, that doesn't mean he's ready to be a good NBA player. That just means I have a sick fascination with his game, and that so I like watching him play.
And like I've seen this a lot of times where a guy tries out stuff in the preseason, and then the season comes and he falls back into his old habits because that's what you're comfortable with.
Exactly. I mean, it's a lot easier to do this stuff in the preseason when the talent is watered down because starters aren't normally getting their usual minutes. And the schemes, like, no one's really running anything.
We were asking Brian Shaw yesterday before the game about, you know, how much of your offense have you installed? And he was like, almost nothing at all.
Yeah.
He's like, we're just running basic stuff. I just want them to figure out what they're supposed to be doing.
Yeah. I just for S's and G's, I looked up Nick Young, how many times he's had three assists or more in his career. 40 times.
And the thing is, now it's fun to watch him, and it's all like, oh, Swaggy P, and everyone's having a – and Lakers fans are like, yeah, this is fun now. It's not going to be fun in February.
He's played 416 games. 40 times he's hit three assists or more, which I love that about him. That's why I called him, like, the ultimate gunner. It's because he doesn't pass. He doesn't turn the ball over. All he does is shoot.
And I'll say this. I think this is a reason why I dislike gunners and probably part of why you like gunners. They're just wired that way. Yeah. I always say this. It's exceptionally hard to get a gunner not to change his game fundamentally and become more of a playmaker and all-around guy. You're pretty much either wired that way or you're not. If you're a guy that is just, I'm going to shoot – changing that about you is, I think, exceptionally difficult for whatever reason.
Yeah, and it is kind of a, like, some people think I'm making fun of the gunner and every, like, I honestly, we've gotten,
no.
I honestly enjoy this. I love it about that. I think it brings a level of excitement and a level of fun to basketball that you can't really find in other ways. And, you know, I'm, like, we've talked before, I'm into the analytics. I believe in it. I really do. But I think you and I agree it's gone a little too far into the extreme one way. And part of me is just like, I don't know, this narrative's really fun. Watching this guy chuck shots against the defense because he's just like, oh, screw this, I bet I can score. Like, that's just fun to me. And there's a certain part of basketball coverage where I look at it, I'm just like, all right, I want to be right. And I accept the analytics and I believe in them for the most part. But there's also part of me that just wants to see a guy chuck shots because that's fun.
Those moments when a guy gets super extremely hot and just goes on a roll, that's one of the most fun parts about watching basketball.
Oh, God, it's just, yeah.
I mean, you know, Anthony Bennett the other night was – which, by the way, I'm not going to mention his nickname I've given him because you hate nicknames. So I will give you this. Any terrible nickname I came up with, I will not mention on this podcast, okay?
Wow, I give that a week.
I will not mention any stupid nicknames I give out to you on this podcast.
Okay.
That's my pledge for this season.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's not even my birthday yet.
But in return, you have to tolerate it on Twitter. That's the bargain.
I can deal with that.
Okay. Anthony Bennett the other night had an absolutely fantastic run in the fourth quarter. Some of them were pretty good shots, but the thing that was exciting about it was he was making them. Like, yes. When they go on those runs, it's really exciting. Like, the analytics stuff, I think, is interesting from a couple of ways. I always look at it as if something feels different to you from watching it, if you're like, well – I get that the numbers say this, but I've watched it and it doesn't seem like that. Like, it feels very different. Don't say I've seen it because you haven't seen every possession. That's what drives me crazy. Is when guys act like, well, I watch the games. I'm like, really? Do you watch every single possession in intricate detail and then log it in your brain? Because guess what? You only have so much internal memory.
Yeah,
I studied psychology. Like, your memory can't hold that much information.
Right. Maybe they don't remember their parents' names or their phone numbers. Then I would start to believe.
Exactly. Although I don't remember things like my mom's birthday because I don't deal with numbers. Anyway, I think it's her birthday in like 2 weeks. Happy birthday, Mom.
So I'm sure she's listening.
she probably is.
She's like, oh, this is the podcast that they're talking about Nick Young. I'm gonna listen.
I'm gonna listen. I do love that Swaggy P. but I always find it to be the thing where if there's an analytics element that doesn't make sense, you have to discover what the context is behind those numbers that explains it. Kobe's the one that everybody uses with the clutch shots perspective, and that one is honestly, it's one where it feels different because your brain is actually wired to remember dramatic moments of makes more than it's wired to remember misses. You just don't remember. We don't remember misses as well as we remember makes. It's
right.
Just
yeah.
The way we're wired.
Unless you're trying to consistently take a player down a peg, like they've done with LeBron. LeBron struggled from in clutch situations for a while, and people are like, oh, I remember this miss, I remember that one, because, you know, it's all confirmation bias. It's all what you want to be important, right?
Yeah.
And so
I do find that problematic, though, from coaches, because a lot of coaches say, I like to use stats to reinforce what I already see. I'm like, well, that's not really learning anything from it. You know? It's like using base facts in order to reinforce your point and make you seem like you're right.
Right.
I think that's how it works, but I think there are things to look at. I was talking to a GM the other day, and he was saying that he thinks analytics have gone too far in devaluing the mid-range shot. Now, I don't necessarily agree with him because statistically speaking, that number, if you shoot a high volume of them, not even high volume, like over time, you're just going to lose points per possession on that shot. No one's able to shoot it effectively enough
right.
for it to be of value to you outside of maybe six or seven players in the league. If you have Kevin Durant, he can shoot that all day.
Yeah.
Kevin Garnett on the pick and pop can take that 18-footer as much as he wants because he shoots something like 54% from it. If you're making over that 1 point, we've talked about this before, the 1.0 points per possession, it's totally great. But what he was saying, and this is something I think you'll probably agree with, he said just having that threat of it does help your spacing. You can't just space the floor with guys inside and guys on the perimeter. You do need, with certain systems, you need to be able to space the floor with a mid-range shooter or a guy that can shoot off the dribble. And having that weapon does help your spacing.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think that that is – I think maybe that's where the talk of devaluing it is. Teams and coaches in particular, they don't want any part of the floor to necessarily be taken away in terms of value, right? Like they want a threat essentially at every point of the floor, because if you have a threat everywhere, then you get the defense scrambling and it makes your offense in theory run a little hotter than it normally would. So like saying, oh, this guy taking a 16-footer is a terrible shot for us isn't really it may be proven over time through analytics, but you want other teams to feel that threat. And right. it's kind of funny on, I think it was Media Day. Must have been Media Day for the Wolves. There were two different sides of the coin for that, where Dante Cunningham at one point talked about his mid-range game and how that's a weapon for him and how defenses have to respect it. And then I think it was Rick Adelman at one point who just casually mentioned that the mid-range game isn't really something that helps them. So that was kind of an interesting juxtaposition of the two sides, whereas Dante Cunningham, that's where he's going to make his money, is playing defense and being a pick and pop guy. That's where you yes. want him on your team. Whereas if you're a coach, you want shots of the rim, free throws, and 3-point attempts.
And Brian Shaw is very different in that with the Nuggets, he very much wants his bigs to be able to step back and hit the short range jumper.
Yeah.
He's looking for that a lot. They're going to run a lot of pick and pop action in the offense this year. It's one of the reasons that I think once Darrell Arthur kind of gets in the flow and if he gets some minutes, could be very good for them. You saw JaVale's working on a lot of that. Kenneth Faried's struggling with it right now. But they're kind of looking for that adjustment. As a side note to the terrible preseason game I saw last night, one thing that's kind of funny to watch in preseason is, it's generally speaking, preseason games are kind of easy, especially for the veterans. They're kind of going half speed and everything's kind of fine. Shaw, because he's trying to instill new defensive principles, is demanding that no one is switching and everyone's going over all the screens. So the Spurs decided to screen Ty Lawson 17 times in the first 5 minutes. I thought he was going to die.
That seems extreme.
Like, I mean, they were nailing him too. Baines and Splitter were just leveling him, and Lawson's still trying to get through. He wound up hurting his back because he was trying to get through all those screens.
Oh my god!
And I was kind of like, I asked Shaw later. I was like, isn't that kind of a concern with forcing your star point guard, who's like 5'10", to go through all these screens? And Shaw's reaction, this is not what he said, this is me paraphrasing, was basically, if he dies, he dies.
I mean, he's like 165 pounds, right?
Yeah.
Or maybe he's, I don't know, maybe he's 175 or something. That's not a lot of person.
Nate Robb was having fun with it. Nate Robb was like busting through.
Right. Nate Robinson's a football player.
Yeah. Nate Robinson thought it was amazing, but with Ty Lawson, you could tell it was like going through, and he had that look on his face like, ow, ow, ow. So that was unfortunate. Speaking of ow, I'm really bummed about Trey Burke.
Trey Burke, Brandon Jennings, all these point guards going down.
We're getting all these, and the rookies too. We got CJ McCollum and Trey Burke.
Yeah,
it's not good. We lost Jarrett Jack over the weekend. That's not a rookie, but there's another guy.
Yeah,
half the guys that are on the Warriors bench last year are now hurt.
Which is
ironic because most of their starters have injury issues.
Yeah, I'm not so sure that Harrison Barnes is hurt.
You don't think so?
I've heard from a few people that maybe not.
What's the deal?
It might be a confidence thing.
But the plus minus numbers are so good with him at the four. Sorry, I hate this Harrison Barnes at the four thing. You know this. I just hate it.
I like it, and I mean, I wouldn't play him 38 minutes there, but I in certain matchups, I think it's great. But yeah, I don't know that all these injuries are necessarily, that seems to be like kind of the thing that's popping up, and maybe we already always knew it, but it just seems to be more aware because of Twitter. But there were conversations on Twitter yesterday about how John Wall knew he had like a fracture in his kneecap, right?
That's a really awkward situation because the team maintains it was a stress reaction and not a fracture, and Wall has said several times, I had a stress fracture.
Right.
Which the team is basically saying, no, he's too stupid to understand what a doctor is telling him.
But here's,
and John Wall's like,
here's $80 million.
Yeah. And John Wall's like, well, the doctor said you have a stress fracture.
Right.
So I think I had a stress fracture.
Yeah, it's reading between the lines on a lot of these injuries. Especially when it's like the nagging ones. There are some teams that are, you know, Carmelo Anthony could have a severe foot injury tomorrow and the Knicks PR would say he's day-to-day.
Right.
Like, there's just some teams that phrase it a little differently. Whereas the Timberwolves, I feel, are quite honest about it because they're at this point, they're like, you know our guys are injured.
Yeah. And then, man, the Cavaliers.
Yeah.
I'm getting a little nervous. As a promo, by the way, we are 1 week out from over-unders, man.
One week.
I'm excited. I gotta start working on it. I'm gonna pull up the old spreadsheet later and start doing some work on it. Cavs are looking like an under because I'm starting to get worried with, I know Jack's not gonna miss any significant time in the regular season. It's just, I get worried when teams have this spate of injuries to start the year, and that can turn into an absolute epidemic.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that, it's such a rough track history. Like, if someone came out and said to me, I don't think the Wolves are going to make the playoffs because I don't believe they're going to be healthy, it's kind of hard to argue with that. Like, I don't like to assume that teams are going to get injured until they actually do, just because I think, like, that's a little defeatist for me. But at the same time, I can't fault someone for believing that. And if you feel that about the Wolves, you feel about the Blazers, you feel about the Cavs, like, there's enough of a track history or track record to be like, yeah, that probably will happen.
Well, I see, and part of it is I really would like to study more about the trainers. I would really like to actually be informed about this because your general perceptions are so uninformed and uneducated. Because on the surface, if you told me three of the Suns players had minor injuries, I'd be like, well, they're definitely going to play on opening night. Like, yeah, they'll be fine. They're 100% going to be okay because the Suns training staff are warlocks. But if you told me Cleveland, or really as much as everyone lauds Gary Vee, and I don't know him personally, and everyone says good things about him, but if you tell me a Laker's going to miss time, I always tack on extra 2 weeks. It's just kind of what happens.
Yeah.
Those guys don't come back early. And I will say I've been impressed with the Warriors. The Warriors are taking guys that have had repetitive issues and kind of done pretty good. Like, even though Bogut obviously had the issue and didn't get better last year, I still feel like they've done a better job in terms of helping him get back than maybe they could have. And Steph seems to be okay.
I agree with that. And that, you know, that seems to be, I guess, the next wave of understanding basketball and what's going to happen. Are teams really taking the fitness and the training and all in the medical side of it into a much serious, you know, much more serious light? And really trying to figure out how do we get ahead of it instead of reacting to it. And there are some teams that do, like we've talked about, the Phoenix Warlocks are just that, like they seem to know like 4 days before a guy's going to get sick.
The Jazz are not going to do this because they have, I just don't think they will. And Trey Burke says he's only going to be out 4 weeks, which means he'll only miss 2 weeks of the regular season. But they're so short at point guard that I actually had a trade concept come up in my brain the other day that I like a lot, which is Andre Miller for Brandon Rush, straight up.
That would be who? Oh, okay, because then they have Nate Robinson as a backup point guard.
Yeah,
in Denver,
and you can run Randy Foy out if you want.
Yeah. Oh, I like that.
And this way, the Nuggets get $4 million expiring. Miller's on for an extra year, which is what Jazz fans flip out over. He's only guaranteed for two next year. So,
and he gets to go back to Utah.
And he gets to go back to Utah. And they get a veteran to teach Burke, which I think is really good for them. They get a solid backup point guard. He does a lot of good things for them. If you want to go ahead and if you want to cut him in the offseason, you can buy him out for $2 million, and then he gets to go join a contender. and the Nuggets get to have more time for Nate Robinson, and Rush can play the two, right? I'm not crazy about this.
Oh yeah, I think he's like a 2-3. I don't think he really has a position other than just wing.
Right, and they get a two guard that's able to ride on Sky Mountain. So
sure,
because Randy Foy, I understand, is fairly tall, but I always refer to it as he plays small. That's how I always refer to it, because it's how they seem on the court. Randy Foy seems tiny to me when he's out there. I mean, this is their four-guard lineup. It's Lawson, Foy, Robinson, Miller, and Fournier. Five. That's five. Fournier is like the biggest guy that they have. So it's tiny. So I like that. I would like that trade-off, but the Jazz won't go for it probably because I think they want the expiring, and Jazz fans are like, oh no, they're really big on Brandon Rush. Guess what? Everyone's always big on somebody when you trade for them.
Right. Everyone's big on a player, you know, with 2 weeks left to go in preseason.
Yeah, it takes a while. Unless you're like Rick Carlisle, who just abandons guys instantaneously.
Right. Or unless you're, you know, actually Quentin Richardson, then you're just going to get moved all the time.
What else we got? Oh, I did two Marcus Teague trade rumors over the weekend.
I saw that. Big weekend.
Which I just decided to become the Marcus Teague trade rumor guy.
I saw the that the Wolves were interested, and I just thought, I was like, well, it makes sense. They do actually need a third point guard. And then I thought, oh, Jesus, who are they going to trade? Like, maybe
Darren Wolfson from the local ESPN station said that he thought that rumor was traced back to Khan and not Flip.
It would not shock me.
So that would make a lot of sense. It did. Casey Johnson, the excellent reporter from the Tribune, didn't stipulate when the interest had come, so it was mostly just background information that I take and then get traffic out of.
Yeah.
So Rose missed that game on Saturday. It's no big deal. I wrote a thing about how the Bulls are right, because basically Rose said, "Well, I would have played," but the Bulls said, "Are you sore?" And he said, "Yes." And they said, "You're not playing." And I think that was a really good move on their part to be hyper cautious. There's no upside for them to be aggressive with it.
Absolutely, especially preseason. Like,
well, and then you have to factor that, you know, who his coach is.
Right.
Oh, you're sore? Oh, don't worry, we'll get you some rest. You're going to only play 38 minutes.
Halftime's rest, right?
Halftime counts as rest.
Well, I mean, there's all the LeBron stuff.
Yeah, fascinating interview with Chris Broussard, who did an excellent job.
That was really good.
I tend to pay attention to actual interview structure, and Q&As are something that's really difficult for me. And so I thought he did an excellent job, both him and I'm sure his editorial team, in terms of translating that interview into a very digestible, comfortable, good flow for the interview structure, which I'm sure everyone cares about. But the actual interview substance, I thought was really good.
Yeah, I thought it was excellent. You know, the stuff about Michael Jordan is fascinating. Just a sense of his reasoning was funny to me about why they don't have a relationship, why one never fostered. And he's like, well, we're just busy guys. Like, no, you don't go out with a girl because you have busy schedules. Like, fostering a relationship when you've been in the league for 10 years, like, that's different. There's a competitive thing there. And I think it's probably mutual. I think there's Jordan saying, you've got to prove that you are actually worthy of being in the conversation with me before I'm going to reach out to you, which, you know, he didn't reach out that much to Kobe early on, right? Like, it seemed to kind of take a while before there were stories of them being like kind of closer. And, yeah, and part of that is probably because they got to play against each other briefly, but they still play against each other. And the fact that he never played against LeBron, right? He never played against LeBron.
No.
Right. LeBron came in right after he retired from the Wizards. And, you know, there's never been that head-to-head competitive thing, even for a game, which I think can matter to a lot of athletes. And then on LeBron's side, it's kind of been like, you know, I'm going to be the most important athlete in NBA history, or, you know, I'm going to be a billionaire athlete, or whatever his goals were early on. And there's just a lot for him to deal with, in the sense of maybe you're not always going to reach out to that father figure of sorts, that you know, kind of idol that you're aspiring to surpass, because you don't want to go about it the same way. You want to do it your own way. That can be correct. That can also be a little childish. Like, I think there's just a lot of, like if I had to guess, I would say there's a lot of just kind of a pissing contest, right?
To me, I think it's if I'm looking at it from James's perspective and what I knew of James, it seems more that I think he would think, one, I don't think it would cross his mind to be like, you know, I should really call today. I should call Michael Jordan and ask him to guide me and to be my life partner, like, you know, my life coach. And so that there's that part of it. And then it's also it's like awkward, right? I was just wondering if you could teach me how to be a Hall of Fame player. That seems awkward. And then I wrote about this in when I wrote about the post, which is that this isn't who Jordan is. And we allowed him for it and we loved him for it. And we now kind of pity him for it. He's hyper competitive and he has never taken a huge interest in mentoring guys after him. I credit Kobe Bryant a lot for the fact that he's kind of taken Carmelo Anthony under his wing and that he kind of embraced Blake Griffin. The fact that he's actually reached out to guys as he's gotten older a little bit more. In general, Jordan, I mean, Scottie Pippen basically had to damn near kill someone in order for Jordan to be like, fine, you are worthy. You may play next to me. And then Tony Kukoc did nothing wrong except being liked by Jerry Krause, and Jordan made it a habit of destroying him. I mean, the guy is hyper-competitive. If you can be hyper-competitive to a fault, Michael Jordan's hyper-competitive to a fault. Right. And that's how he is. And again, this is what made him the greatest of all time. You cannot extract the two. You can't sit there and say, well, he's a great player, but he was too competitive. He was a great player because he was too competitive. And you and I have talked about this a lot with Tim Grover's book, Jordan's Trainer and Kobe's Trainer and Wade's Trainer, the cleaner concept.
Yes.
Jordan's a cleaner, LeBron's a closer, and that's very apparent from this interview because he talks about how – he says in the interview, he says, I'm afraid of failure. That takes – to me, that takes huge –
onions.
Stones, yeah. Huge stones to admit. And even in the comfy confines of an interview with Chris Broussard, who he has a relationship with on ESPN, that still takes a lot for anybody to say, I'm afraid of failure. Even though it's basically true for every human being, we just deal with it differently. Cleaner, yeah. The cleaner concept would say you're not afraid of failure. You're not afraid of anything. You just execute it. And that's great as a conceptual model. I don't know if that's necessarily realistic within the framework of the actual human brain.
Yeah, and I'm always someone where, you know, it's part of the culture with basketball and, well, sports in general, to where emotions always make you lesser of a person, lesser of a competitor. I actually think being able to acknowledge you have emotions, acknowledge that they affect you, and then still try to overcome those in the moment, like, to me, that's more of an adult thing to do. That's more of a mature thing to do. That's more of a competitive thing to do in the sense that, yeah, like, yep, that scares me. I'm still going to go defeat it.
Yeah.
Like, because that's what I want to do. Like, for me, like, I get the argument against that. But for me, him saying, like, any player coming out and saying, I'm afraid of failure. Well, if you don't fail that often anymore, that means that you've overcome that fear in a way, right? Or you've at least looked at that fear in the eye and said, all right, let's go. Like, I don't look at that as, if Kobe came out tomorrow and said, I'm afraid of failure, that's why blah, blah, blah. If anything, that would make me like him even more if that's possible.
Yeah.
I don't get how that can be. I mean, I understand the argument for it, but like the fact that will be kind of picked apart, I'm just like, ugh, that, I don't know. That sounds really mature to me.
They asked him, or Broussard asked him, how do you deal with it? How do you overcome being afraid of failure? And he said, just win. He said, keep winning and I don't have to worry about it. Keep winning, right. Which is a great way to close the interview, by the way. Again, props to Broussard for putting this together. But it reminded me of, there's an oatmeal cartoon on theoatmeal.com, which talks about his long distance running. And it says that the way he motivates himself to run is that he conceptualizes this fat creature that dogs him, but like chasing him. And it basically shouts out all his insecurities and tells him to do things like, you don't want to do this. Let's go home and sit on the couch and eat gravy and things like that. And he calls it the blurch. To me, failure is like LeBron's blurch, and it's like constantly chasing him. Everybody's got their own way of overcoming challenges. For me, this has been the only approach that I struggled for a long time trying to be successful at almost anything. The only way that I started to be successful at things was I narrowed them down to where there was the least amount of risk possible in my brain. So with writing, it was, you know, a lot of people are like, well, what if I write it and it's bad? Or what if I write this and people don't like it? Or what if no one pays attention to it? And so I just kind of told myself, instead of pursuing journalism and doing the whole formal route, I basically was like, I'm just going to kind of do this. And if it works, great. And if not, oh, well. And that put me in a position to where I succeeded. I had to minimize risk in my brain, which is a way less brave approach than saying, I'm terrified of this, but I'm going to take it head on anyway. So I think there's a lot to be said. So.
Whereas I thought, I want to do this. I'm going to quit my job and not have income.
But I think for you, the biggest – you fall more into the Jordan Bryant model, because I think for you it was, everybody says I can't do this.
That really,
bleep you.
That really did
I'll quit my job.
It really did piss me off that I wanted to write and my friends were just like, why? You're not going to do this.
Right?
Like, why would you do that?
I'll show you. I'll quit my job and have no other option.
Watch me. I'm going to take a year. I'm going to quit my job and not have any income. They're just like, why? Why would you end a decision?
See, again, this makes me wonder. I want to take you to Vegas and get you hammered, and then we'll just see if I start telling you things that you can't do.
Oh, God. I don't even know that we really need to get me hammered. Maybe that would make it more fun. But I do – it bothers me. One thing out of that interview I liked was – Broussard asked him, you know, essentially, was the finals loss to Dallas a turning point in your career? And I like that he said, I've had so many turning points in my career. And I think that that's one thing. We always look at the athlete progression as a linear thing. And it's actually quite a zigzag going back and forth, side to side. Like, there's to become LeBron James, to become Michael Jordan, to become Kobe Bryant, there really isn't just a straight path, right?
Yeah.
It's this thing of like, no, you have this immediate success, and then you get knocked down, and then you have more success, and then you kind of just sputter there for a little bit, and then you get knocked back again, and then you have to strive forward. Like, it's never just I'm going to go forward, forward, forward. Like, It's not my player mode on NBA 2K. It's just not. Like, you have so many points where you have to suck it up and find a way to get better or find a way to make things happen. And I just thought that was like a cool little moment of, I've had so many turning points in my career. Like, there's not just one thing where a flip switch happens and you're like, all right, now I'm going to be great. Like, it's just, it doesn't work that way.
I'm also a big fan of, this is a real subtle thing that he did. They asked him about Jordan and why he wished he had a relationship with it. He says, I want to go through his mind frame through all the different things. And the first thing he said was, throughout his pains, you know, not being able to get past Detroit, then overcoming Detroit. To me, that was very much a very subtle way of going, you know, everyone said that I was this loser, artichoke salt baby who was never going to accomplish anything, much the same way that everyone said the same thing about Jordan when he lost in 90.
That was a little jab of like, hey, remember when that guy wasn't winning all the time?
Yeah. Remember that? Because it seems to happen to all of us. And that's what kind of makes Bryant's path so different, right?
Yeah.
Is that he started off and he won three titles with Shaq immediately. And that altered, I think, his trajectory. And I think, to me, you can make the argument. You can say, well, one, he wasn't the dominant player on that team. Shaq was. And two, you can make the argument, well, that kind of set him up better for success because he's already immediately at that level. For me, I always take it the opposite way, because this is how I feel about Wade, which is winning a championship when you are that young impresses the hell out of me. Being ready that young to compete in the finals is crazy, because once you've covered a finals and you see how hard guys are playing up close and personal, it is shocking. The gap between what I saw last night in that preseason game and the execution of the finals, it's just amazing how different one game, the same game, being played at different levels can be. It was just absolutely crazy.
Yeah, I agree. And that's kind of I think that's the fun thing about Kobe is it just made him kind of great already, like right away, and then he had to deal with that a different way. And, you know, it seems like we're fawning over this because, well, we are, because it's a great Q&A. But that's the fun thing about Kobe is you can kind of get that from him at all times, right? You just ask him a question. He's at a point in his career and in his life, and he has been really since the Colorado incident, of just like, I'm just going to speak my mind. Screw all this, like, speaking for sponsors and stuff. Like, I got dropped. I'm just going to be the natural me. And the natural him is just giving out the kind of these gems of, of answers all the time.
I actually have grown to like him more because he's not coy about it. I really like that he doesn't do the Phil Jackson, like, I'm kind of making a joke, but not really. He doesn't do any of that. He's like, no, I don't respect that. Like no. No, he shoots too much. What do you want?
Right.
You know, or no, like, of course I'm frustrated with Lamar Odom. He makes me insane. Wouldn't you be crazy if you had to watch him throw the ball out of bounds? Come on. I like that he is very blunt with his assessments of things. Just this morning, Jared Zwirling of Bleacher Report, again, weird, came out with a pretty good article. Andrew Wiggins, projected number one pick. He's got two sources with quotes saying that Adidas is ready to offer $180 million over 10 years to that young man.
That's more than I make to endorse shoes.
Wouldn't it be great if we got endorsements? Why can't a program, an app should sponsor us, right?
Anything really, but I
literally anything.
Literally anything. I just want to be one of those guys that gets free shoes. That's all I want. You don't even have to pay me. I just want to, you know, every once in a while you see a string of writers like post a picture on Twitter of like, hey, thanks Adidas Man 23. I'm just like, oh, that's cool. I just want new shoes. I don't have any room for them, but that's what I want.
This concludes Zach begging for free stuff on the EOB podcast.
Oh, it will never conclude.
No, I mean for today. Oh. Hopefully. I asked for a read about his new crazy ghost from Adidas because I'm desperate to find any way to make small talk with players. And like, Ty Lawson, I can talk about shoes all the time with. Like he's a shoe guy. So I will, if I see a good shoe, I would just be like, hey, what'd you think of this? And I'll act like I know what he's talking about. I asked for a read. I said, so how you like this crazy ghost? And he was like, which ones? And I was like, the shoes. He's like, which ones? The ones that they're promoting for you? Oh, they're too narrow. I just kind of like cocked my head and was like, what? And he was like, yeah, they really hurt my feet. And he was like, no, I'm just kidding. But no, seriously, they hurt my feet. But no, I'm just kidding. He did that to me. He did the no really, but yeah.
You're like, I don't know what to do with this information.
Yeah. Fareed was in a rare good mood last night. Usually he's pretty snippy after any situation involving the media, and he was pretty good last night. What else we got? Oh, I have a real quick game I want to play.
Okay.
I'm gonna take we'll take three teams and we'll do it because I want to kind of intersperse this. What are the regular season opponents that matter for these teams? Regular season, we always talk about games not mattering. Let's start with the New York Knicks. Give me three games that matter for them in the regular season.
Nets, Heat, Pacers.
Okay. Those are all – it's three Eastern Conference teams, which is going to make sense. Most of them are going to be conference opponents.
Yeah.
I agree with you on the Pacers 100%. The Nets, I'll agree with you just from the perspective of – I'm not sure it matters so much for them in a bigger context. I think it matters – I think from a professional level, there are things – it's like anything else where if you're at work and you're trying to get something accomplished, you care about your primary objective. But if there are little objectives along the way you can accomplish, you kind of care about those. It's like a side mission in a video game.
That's how I would think. Exactly. You're doing a taxi mission in Grand Theft Auto. And that's,
I knew you were going to pull GTA in.
Or you're doing the full court drill in my player mode. It's and I don't know that it matters – so much to the Knicks as it does the Nets, but there's going to be so much coverage around it that there's no way they can escape it, and so that's why it's going to matter for them.
I think I disagree about the Heat. I think at this point, to me, last year was a chance for them to kind of reassert that, but one, because of their playoff failure, and two, because of the fact that basically in the later meetings, the Miami was like, no, 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 no. Oh, just kidding. No, I don't really think that's a rivalry. I actually think that maybe here's one. I think actually Oklahoma City matters.
Oh, the little Durant Mello rivalry.
That one, you know, they were competitive games last year. It's two good teams. They're in similar positions in terms of they're contenders within their own conference that have major question marks about them. And I feel in general, and I also love the contrast of Oklahoma City and New York, much of the way that I love Indiana and New York. Now, I think Indiana are the games that they really need to prove. Like, they need to win those games and they need to do it. You don't have to win convincingly in scoring margin. You need to feel like, wow, like they took care of business and they won that game.
Yeah.
I think that's important for them, that this is a, I think, and that's, this is a rivalry now, I think, honestly. Knicks Pacers, I think, is a rivalry. They're in same conference. They're battling over the same level of playoff spots. They have a historic tradition and they have guys that don't like each other, and they're contrasting styles as well. Where it's isolation ball versus no real superstar.
Well, and also there's this sense of, like, the Pacers are the best team at defending the three. And the Knicks shoot the most threes out of anybody. And so there's this, just this, this kind of, like, it's almost like a fastball pitcher trying to throw his fastball by a guy who is a home run hitter on fastballs, right? Like, yeah. It's just this, like, I'm going to challenge you with my best stuff, even though you do it well. You combat this area really well, and we're just going to see who's left standing. And I think that kind of philosophical thing, and it's kind of like, you know, you're talking about the no superstars versus star-studded isolation ball. That's kind of where the disconnect is, and it's the same with the three-point defense versus the three-point chucking, to where it's just like, it, stylistically, they couldn't be more different.
I'll have to send you the quotes. I asked Shaw last night about how to defend the Spurs, which are a volume three-point shooting team. And Shaw went back to Indiana versus New York. He brought that up on his own. And it was really cool to hear him talk, because he was talking not about – everyone focuses on how do you make them shoot a low percentage. And Shaw said, I don't care about what they shoot. He's like, I care about the number of attempts we allow.
Yeah.
He's like, we can only control so much at the point of release. But we have to prevent the attempts. And versus New York, we were able to essentially shave in half their number of three-point attempts.
Yeah,
I thought that was fascinating to hear, and that's something I don't think that I don't remember. You may have talked about it. I don't remember a lot of people talking about it during that series. Was how they basically took the Knicks from a volume three-point shooting team to this thing. This is a tangent. We'll continue this game for another time. But I want to ask you about this, because you have thoughts about the whole volume approach. Because I struggle with it, because I'm like, well, if we're just going to say the volume three-point shooting is always good, and if Steph Curry is – it's basically – like, there's a legitimate argument to be made that a decent offense for the Warriors is for Stephen Curry to literally run up the floor and launch a three from, like, five steps behind the three-point line in transition. Right. Like, there's a legitimate argument there. I'm not making a joke.
No, there is. He's that good of a shooter.
Yeah. So my question is, does discretion – and discernment with your shot attempts from three, does that matter?
Absolutely. I mean, it matters. It matters the space in which you're getting them off in. You can't just go up and – I mean, unless you're Steph Curry, you can't just go up and chuck threes wildly. It's not about necessarily volume. It's about intelligent volume. It's about getting them off ball movement, getting them in to where – ideally, you just want three-point shots where it's a good look in the sense that – you don't really have a contest against it. And that's what we talked about, you know, during the playoffs of Denver versus the Warriors, was Stephen Curry actually being challenged on the shots, right? And right. So that's more the key, I think, is that can you get your shot off knowing that the defender doesn't have a chance to contest it? Because then that puts you at ease. It's a better shot. You know, you can't have Raymond Felton chucking from 30 feet and just saying, hey, look, it's okay. That's what J.R. Smith's for. What you need are guys like J.R. Smith or like Carmelo who can operate one-on-one in space, coming off the pick and roll, swinging the ball, getting the ball swung to them, to where they are getting essentially a clear view at the shot. And I think that's the important part of the volume, not just wildly chucking.
Even like 3 years ago, I would have said in most instances, outside of someone like Steve Nash, that someone taking a three off of the dribble, in almost any situation, like unless it was like you dribble up the court and no one was guarding you, he just was like, all right. I mean, in that case, it's okay because you got time to kind of set. But in most situations, coming off of a pick in a dribble situation, I would almost always say that the three-point shots are poor looks, and I'm really kind of done there because I'm looking at – if Jamal Crawford comes off the screen and he's open, he should shoot. If J.J. Redick is coming off the pick even now, he's getting better in that capacity. That's, I think, another evolution for Paul George, is being able to come off the pick and hit that three. You know, Curry obviously is the model for it. it's one reason. Maybe this is why Nate Robinson is not just seems like it, but becoming a little bit more valuable as a player, because his skill set kind of translates to that. Like, he's able to go behind that pick and launch.
That's where he's good, right? Is being able to have space off that pick to where he can get a shot off, because when he has space, his shot's pretty good.
So I think it's an interesting kind of translation. The Clippers are another one where I'm kind of curious. If you if you've got Jared Dudley, Jamal Crawford, J.J. Redick, Willie Green, who I know you don't like, Chris Paul, with that backcourt, can you loosen up with your discretion of three-point shots in order to increase volume? Because that's, I think, the balance is we've established that you have to have some discretion.
Right.
So now the question is, how good of a look do you have to work for different teams?
And you know, Chris Paul coming off that pick, I think we all want him shooting that ball, right?
Yeah.
Jamal Crawford, we just mentioned. The other guys, they're more spot-up guys. Like, they can take a dribble here and there, but you're really trying to create that volume for them off of kickouts. And so it really will be a case-by-case guy, or a case-by-case with each shoot.
Yeah, so I get from a case-by-case thing. I think it's interesting to look at, and maybe you and I should work on a post on this, on what on a 1-10 scale of what we think a team's level of discretion with selecting their three-point shots would be based on their personnel.
Yeah, I'm into that.
Because the Spurs, I think, are pretty selective, and that's what makes them so good, is they're able to create the shot that they want so much. But not a lot of teams are able to execute at that level. And so it's like an interesting question, right? Like, maybe Memphis, I actually don't know the answer to that question, because on one level I'm like, well, they really need to make sure they get good shots because they can't shoot. But on the other level, I'm like, they can't shoot anyway, so maybe they should just shoot more.
Right. With Memphis, they're one of the few teams where I'm like, if you don't have the personnel to do it, you shouldn't be shooting.
Okay.
You know, and I think that, like, for them, there are certain identities where I would much rather have Marc Gasol and Zach Randolph beating up the other team inside and in the mid post than to just say, like, hey, Tony Allen, why don't you throw up a few more shots from outside and let's see if any of them go in. Where I think that there are some teams like this. I mean, the Spurs, other than Manu and Gary Neal last year, you didn't have a lot of guys shooting off the dribble, right? It's not like Matt Bonner was creating for himself with a crossover three like he's Evan Turner. Like, that just wasn't happening. All their stuff came off of ball movement, but their ball movement is so good that they can kind of take a higher volume than you would normally expect a team who's firing away off the dribble.
I think it's a real interesting question as we look at, you know, I've talked about the evolution of the league and towards this three point evolution, because I'm also really interested in how this is going to affect things. Like, for so long, the big man inside has been the dominant force, and I wrote a lot on this last year, but there's this huge gap between the value of a dominant defensive man inside and any sort of perimeter defender, and that's reflected in the Defensive Player of the Year votes historically.
Yeah.
I'm interested to see if some of that's going to shift a little bit based off of preventing three-point attempts is becoming a significant part of this game. That's a huge element in playing great defense, and really one of the things that the great defenses are exceptional at. You could be a really good interior defensive team, but if you're allowing a high volume of three-point teams, I'm not sure, three-point shots, I'm not sure you can survive in this league defensively anymore.
Yeah, I don't think you can at all. And to that point, you know, I almost wonder if Paul George has a much better chance at winning Defensive Player of the Year than Roy Hibbert, just for the simple fact that the game has shifted so much to the perimeter. If Paul George is part of a defense that is taking away three-point attempts, will that eventually be valued more than just deterring guys at the rim?
That's a really interesting question. We are 1 week away from over-unders. We are 2 weeks away from the start of the season. What guest do you have this week?
I actually don't have any yet.
Okay. Well, that was a failed attempt at us doing promos the rest of the week.
Right. Actually, my entire week got really screwed up. But we will have guests. I know that. Tune in to find out who.
Tune in to find out who. I'll be back with you guys on Thursday. Zach's got something coming later day on stretch four, is that right?
That's right. The value of the stretch four comparing offense and defense.
And I've got stuff later in the week on continuing the Young Gun series, talking about breakouts. I'm talking about breakout centers. And I'm breaking down the odds for different player awards in terms of their handicapped odds on Friday. Looking forward to that. The MVP awards or MVP odds just came out. Some really interesting stuff there. Rose is much lower than I expected. The Rookie of the Year stuff is really in transition with Burke's injury. Ben McLemore is coming up. By the way, I'm on the Ben McLemore train, dude.
Yeah, welcome aboard.
I'm on the train. I'm ready. This kid looks great.
He's fun.
I'm ready for him to join the long list of players that played at KU, who, of course, I hated being a Missouri alum, and now loving the NBA, along with Paul Pierce, Kirk Heinrich, and Nick Collison, and Mario Chalmers.
And it's, Xavier Henry will, as he shoots up the ranks to being the next Manu Ginobili or James Harden. James Worthy, come on. And I know he was talking about the ability to create space and all this, and it's still stupid.
But really, Xavier Henry, Xavier Henry, Manu Ginobili, don't they mean the same thing? Tie it all back together.
I think that's Tara's next quote.
Thanks, Zach.
Thanks, Matt.